In India, overall, about 50% of grade 5 students can't read something they should have been able to in grade 2. In the state we're talking about, 30% of grade 5 students can read something that they should have been able to read in grade 2. And you can see why there would be resistance to have official metrics necessarily show that.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. When children take tests in school, it can either tell us about that child's individual ability, or it can also give us useful information about how well the school's doing, or even the education system as a whole. We know some individual children will cheat on a test, but how prevalent and how important is large-scale grade inflation? Abhijit Singh of Stockholm School of Economics conducted an experiment in India using the school tests that are being used to evaluate and improve the quality of public education there. And he joins me now. Abhijit, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hello, Tim. Thanks a lot for having me.
First of all, tell me about this test. What's it for? How's it administered?
The paper has two tests, and really the big administrative one there is this test called Pratibha Parv. It's in the state of Madhya Pradesh. It's essentially the state's version of the standardized assessment that tells them everything that's going on in the entire public schooling system, right? So what do kids know, which are the schools that need support? It's meant to be a diagnostic. So that's kind of important because it's not a test that determines whether one child progresses from, say, their current grade to the next grade. It's not something that teachers' promotions or tenure or salaries or anything of that kind is set to. It's really meant to be a way for the state to figure out what are the kind of things that students need more support on, which are the specific areas, which are the specific schools, and to guide all education policy, because eventually that's meant to be about the learning outcomes of kids. And the state very early amongst Indian states, so about 10 years ago, decided that, well, if that's what we want to focus on, then we need to measure it, and we need to measure it regularly, and we need to measure it in every school.
Where we start from is you did an assessment of these test results and how accurate they are, whether they are inflated. How inflated are they?
Okay, so maybe just a little bit of background, which is that it's actually quite hard to figure out whether and how much tests are inflated. What we did was essentially the straightforward version of, I'm told that Tim answered particular questions correctly in the official assessment, and I go within the next month and I ask you exactly the same questions. So that's kind of what we mean by trying to see if essentially you're getting some version of, here is what Tim knows, that is the same over time. And it turns out that for the same questions administered to the same kids, when you go and do this independently, you get levels of achievement that are about half. Right? So the inflation seems to be like a factor of two. To put it concretely, I mean, if there's a test question that the official test is saying 70% of kids got right, we get something more like 35, 40% when we go and ask it. So that's an audit of sorts.
And there's no way that this is happening by accident. People aren't just adding up the scores incorrectly or anything like that. So who is cheating?
There are a combination of things. So there's certainly a certain amount of student copying. And there is also some version of teachers helping their students take the test. And there's some version of teachers inflating grades. So one important piece of context here is that the way that the test happens is that it's a standardized test. So the question papers, the test papers get designed centrally, they get sent out to the schools, but they're administered in the schools by the same teachers. And then eventually the scores are transmitted back up, and that's what goes to inform education policy and the like. There are meant to be some external checks and constraints. We find in direct observation of classrooms that those are actually incredibly weak, right? So a whole bunch of people who are meant to show up to assess the test don't necessarily come. If they come, they come, they meet the head teacher and go back, but not necessarily sit through because, let's be honest, proctoring is a really boring activity. And it's objectively a hard problem. I mean, this is a massive state, right? So even though it's one state in India, you should think of it as being the population of Germany and rather more kids than Germany because it's a younger population. This one state has about 80 million people. So this is the entire public education system of a state that large. And it's about 120,000 schools. So that's a lot of schools that you want to set up some version of invigilation on the same day. The only way you really manage it in this context is with their own teachers. Hmm. Now, in principle, there could have been more benevolent explanations for why you'd see a mismatch compared to the official test versus some random research team comes in and gets you to sit a mathematics test. And maybe Tim on that day just doesn't care about these strangers who came and, you know, doesn't want to answer very much. And that's why he scores badly the second time around. That turns out to probably not be the case. I mean, one is that, you know, we directly observed quite a great degree of student copying and the like. And we got some anonymous interviews, of course, of teachers saying that they'd inflate grades. But even in this setting, so in some grades, what gets done is that the teachers don't grade the own assessments. Mm-hmm. The test papers get sent to a different school. And in the same grade, to make copying across students harder, they have multiple test booklets, right? So you and the person sitting next to you aren't answering exactly the same questions. And that just makes copying harder, right? And the questions are jumbled. Turns out even just that cuts the mismatch between what's happening in the official test and what happens when we show up and ask the same questions. That goes down by about half in mathematics, right? So that doesn't sound to be like people didn't care about the independent test or that they just forgot, right? I mean, maybe I'd just done lots of test prep before the exam and then a month later when we showed up, they'd forgotten. Those kind of explanations just don't get at the heart of this. I mean, I'm pretty certain that most of the mismatch is coming out of some combination of students copying, teachers helping students answer, teachers inflating grades. It's a direct distortion of what the test is meant to do, which is it's meant to tell you what does the student know. And the mismatch is essentially something that distorts it away from the true value.
But why does it happen at all? The teachers aren't rewarded for it, that individual children aren't rewarded for doing well, the schools aren't rewarded for getting a high achievement on all of these tests. What's the incentive here?
That's actually a remarkably hard question to answer. If you asked amongst economists, they would say one wouldn't expect very much distortion in a low-stakes setting of this kind. We asked teachers some of this, and one of the explanations that we hear is if I show what the true levels of achievement are, there'll be somebody annoying me about why our achievement level is so low, and these question papers should be designed trying to capture what the actual level of achievements are. They're asked as if these kids were all high achievers and the like. So some of it really does seem to be about not wanting to bring on the additional hassle that showing absolute achievement levels in this context would be. So for context, independent assessments, so Pratham, which is a great NGO and has done more about measuring student achievement in India than any other organization. In India, overall, about 50% of grade 5 students can't read something they should have been able to in grade 2. Mm. In the state we're talking about, 30% of grade 5 students can read something in the years that we were doing this that they should have been able to read in grade 2. So that's kind of the benchmark. And you can see why there would be resistance to have official metrics necessarily show that. Why do students copy? Well, I think even when there aren't direct incentives, like passing to the next grade that are attached to it, there is something about not wanting to fail an assessment and not wanting to be seen as failing an assessment. And parents do get told about these assessments. And even if you don't add in like high-powered incentives, one can see why, if you make it costless for me to copy from my friend sitting next to me who might know the answer, why being a person subject to temptation might do it.
Is there consistent grade padding across all schools, or is that just the lowest achieving schools do this the most?
So the test happens in all schools for grades 1 through 8, the official test. The audits we only did in a subset of about just under 300 schools. And what seems to be much more of an issue in this setting is exactly which students is the mismatch between the official and the independent test really big for. So it's particularly high for low achieving kids. It's much lower for higher achieving kids, as you would kind of expect. It varies a bit across schools, but there's not that much that I think we can say in this context. In a follow-up experiment, which we did, there's a bit more that I can say about what kind of schools. It doesn't seem to be universal in the sense that there's clearly variation across grades and across schools in this setting as well.
This is a test that, as you say, is used to inform policy, to be able to tell us how well schools are doing. Now that we've uncovered this problem, precisely what problem is that for policymakers?
So the problem is kind of twofold here, right? Which is that, why is it that we conduct assessments at all? We conduct assessments because they're trying to measure something that we want to get to know.
Yeah.
And we intend to make decisions based on that. We intend to make decisions about what kind of support should be sent to which schools, which are the places that might need, you know, some changes in curriculum, which might need some additional inputs. If there is the need for remedial instruction, who are the students who should get remedial instruction and the like? And once you can't trust the metric you base this on, right? Once you can't be sure that the kids who are being flagged up in the remedial instruction are actually the students most in need and might just be the students whose teacher actually stayed in classroom during the entire assessment and made sure nobody was copying from each other. If that's who you're flagging, maybe that's not who needs the support. Maybe those are the ones whose teachers are showing up. So suddenly you can have an inversion of, if you wanted to do something like accountability, one way of trying to think about this is, so if your listeners are in the UK as you are, you know, a lot of weight gets put to whether a school is rated outstanding or good, right, by Ofsted. Like that suddenly shows up in house prices, that shows up in all kinds of ways about who moves into neighborhoods and where they send their kids to school. In principle, that's exactly what the state is trying to do here, right? So these test scores get broken into 5-letter grades that go from A to E, and A is the best. And that's information that's, you know, publicly available. It's not as salient as it is in the UK, but, you know, I mean, this would be one reason why it's not as salient. But if people started making these decisions and it turned out that you'd moved to a school that you thought was outstanding, but maybe it's just a school where everyone copied and the teacher wrote the answers on the blackboard, you'd be very annoyed and justifiably, and you just can't use it for anything. And at that point, it's not obvious why you made, in this case, about 6.5 million kids sit the assessment every year. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of children.
Yes, and a lot of money as well to do it, and a lot of time to do that as well. Is your research, would it be a surprise to the people that are setting up these tests? Or is this just one of those assessments that, well, everybody knows that it's done like this, but no one really wants to rock the boat?
So I think one should think of it in sort of two steps. One is that information might be actually quite different at different levels. Mm-hmm. So clearly the students who copied know that it was copied, and the teachers who administered would know whether or not to base things on it. But go further up the chain, and this is a test that was, you know, called a national best practice. It's what our assessment regime should be based on. So it was called the national best practice by Niti Aayog, which is maybe one of the larger central decision-making or advisory bodies in the national government. The national education policy that we redid in 2020 after about 25 years says we should be doing this in every school. And essentially what they propose doing looks very, very similar. And it looks very similar to what education systems elsewhere do. I mean, it's essentially something that looks very similar to the key stage assessments in the UK, that in certain specific grades, which correspond to certain ages, we should be testing all kids and finding out what they know. And that should set in place some central educational actions, both at the level of the school and at the level of the student. So that's what our education policy says we should do. And well, if you say we should do this in every school, here's a state that really wanted to get this right. And I should mention that by the time that I'm doing this audit, they've been doing it for about 5 years. So these are not teething problems. So how we get from where we're at to the ambition, which is to have the kind of assessments that systems that are seen as better functioning have, is a really big one. And it's that we should either do this properly or not at all.
To your credit, you didn't just expose the problem and then run away and leave it to someone else. You tried a solution that might get more accurate results using technology, didn't you? What did you do?
Right. So this is a large experiment that we did in a separate state. Mm-hmm. This is in Andhra Pradesh. And this was done at a reasonably large scale. So it was done in slightly over 2,400 schools. And what we did was, in about 2/3 of the schools, we decided that instead of doing tests the basic way that they're done, which is that you send the test papers and you get the teachers to administer and you get the answers back, we decided to see if we could have some version of tablet-based testing, even in this context, which is not necessarily a context quite as familiar with technology and smartphones and the like, although that's increasing rapidly, as many of the other settings where things like this have been tried. And the basic idea is the following, right? Which is that if you're testing each kid on a tablet and they're looking at a different question and they're answering on their own device around that time, that it makes it much harder to copy. It also moves grading away from the individual teacher to be done automatically. And that's good both for like reducing discretion, but also because grading burden is genuinely a burden. I mean, there is some justification to complaints that teachers spend too much time having to do paperwork that they don't see add value. So here you assess, and then there's no real follow-up to be done about filing reports and the like, because all of that gets synchronized. And there's many things that, you know, in principle could have gone wrong. Kids aren't necessarily familiar with technology. They may never have seen a mathematics test on a tablet. They may never have worked on a tablet before. And just the logistics. So this is not a high resource setting. So it's not as if all schools have tablets and tablets for all kids. So it's like, you know, one central pool of tablets that gets taken to the school, kids do the assessment, then the tablets come back and then they go to another school. And that's the only way you can keep this cost effective within the kind of budgets that are available, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why this was done at the scale of an entire district. And this was done across private and government schools. And the reason that it was done was that the state really wanted to see what could it do to try and get the kind of community report cards that are completely commonplace in places like the UK. Of the schools in your neighborhood, which are outstanding or not, is a remarkably difficult question to answer unless you have assessment. So in 2/3 of the schools, this is how we did it. In 1/3 of the schools, we did it as these things are normally done, which is that the test was given on paper and the answer scripts were returned. They were graded centrally and the answers put together. This was randomized. So we know that any differences between these sets of schools in how students perform needs to be about how the test metric does. And it turns out that the paper-based tests, on average, kids get about 20 percentage points higher scores out of 100. And those distributions just look quite out of whack just by any metric that we would use in education.
You said the technology seems to create a more representative result here. Did you manage to be able to test whether the technology was creating a problem for kids just to be able to use it?
That's a great question. And that's something that we worried about quite a lot going into this. And what we did was in just under 120 schools, both ones that were tested on paper and ones that were tested on tablets, we went back and did the same assessment over again, but now just done in the familiar paper-based format, right? So the way that kids are used to seeing tests and the like, and that gives us an independent benchmark. And turns out that the scores that children got on this assessment that, you know, we went and did and made sure that no one was copying and we made sure that there was no one providing answers and the like, those agree very closely with the tablet-based assessments, right? So the difference is more like sort of 2 percentage points, 3 percentage points. And that those are very different for the schools where kids had been tested on paper, proctored by their own teacher, you know, in the way that assessments usually are done. So the same kind of audit as we did in the first place, that seems to suggest negligible cheating or negligible student copying and the like in the tablet-based arm, but quite a lot of it in the paper-based arm on the same assessment given on the same day. We also tried to figure out, you know, is there a way that that would work in this setting for states to be able to diagnose this without having to go back and retest everybody, right? So, I mean, that's the other problem. Like, I can go back and do an audit again in like 100 schools, but how do we figure out if there's variation there? And we look at, in both the tablet and the paper-based versions, just suspicious answer patterns. So what we do is we adapt an algorithm that the Italian assessments regime uses to detect cheating in schools. And that's been used in some economics papers by Josh Angrist, who won the Nobel recently, actually. So he has this great paper called Moral Hazard in the Mezzogiorno. And it turns out that there's substantial cheating and it varies quite a lot. And it's 16% in some of the southern provinces, 16% of classrooms, and next to no cheating in the north of Italy. Well, it turns out in this case, that's like 3 times as high, right? So we find something like 40-odd% of classrooms which are flagged for cheating using the same algorithm, and that it's exactly these classrooms where we see the mismatch between the independent test and the official test, right? So these are clearly picking up the same thing. So one advantage there of this kind of move towards technology-based assessments, I mean, one is to reduce burdens on teachers, but the other is that it makes possible these ways of being able to detect cheating in an automated way without the shoe leather costs of needing to go and send some independent audit. And then you only ever figure out in a sample, right? So you kind of know that in the system overall, there's this for cheating, but at some point you need something that tells you about individual classrooms, individual schools and the like.
But Abhijit, you are delivering a double dose of bad news here, aren't you? First of all, that perhaps the tests aren't being administered as well as administrators would hope that they were. And secondly, that the school system isn't working as well as people maybe thought it was. Have you had any negative response, pushback?
To be honest, actually, most of the feedback, including from policymakers and the like, has been pretty positive, or at least open in various respects. The only reason I can do these studies at all is that there are people within the system, within education policymakers, who would like to know what the magnitude of the problem is. So you asked earlier, like, you know, is this a surprise? And the fact is that there's almost no assessment where there aren't some reports of copying or cheating or people trying to have gamed teaching to the test or things of that kind. And a lot of basic policy research is about trying to figure out how large is the problem and are there things in the current arsenal of how to fix it that will work within current budgets that might work here, right? So I think both in Madhya Pradesh and in Andhra Pradesh, there was certainly receptiveness at the central level about trying to take this stuff seriously. Given where the national education policy is and given where, you know, just general direction of education policy has been moving in India, I think people increasingly recognize that we'll be doing tests of these kinds in some form or the other. So trying to fix this, get this right, could have potentially large returns. And it's a thorny problem because it is such a decentralized problem at some level that you need to fix things that will happen independently in 100,000 schools. And how do you go about? So to be honest, I mean, I haven't had tons of pushback. At the same time, and in various states, I think there's been willingness and receptiveness to try out some of these, including in other states. We haven't actually seen that much take up of it, but that's partly because the paper came out and then the pandemic came out. And so schools have been closed and for good reasons, there are many other things that policymakers and parents and schools have been focused on. But I think we'll see some movement here in the next few years.
And it is encouraging that policy is guided by this kind of data collection. But do you have any suspicion that there are other types of administrative data that are being used as a basis for policy that has similar problems with it at the moment?
This is something I think that affects frontline public service delivery across sectors, and not just in India, but more generally. So in India, for instance, there certainly evidence to show that similar issues might occur in data in the healthcare sector, right? So on issues like malnutrition statistics, on issues like vaccination rates and the like. And we've known for a much longer period of time that these issues can be quite rampant in places where they intersect with financial incentives. There's a long literature about, say, workfare programs and workers who don't exist existing as on, you know, the records of employment, or that you actually work for 10 days, but somebody put you down as having worked for 15 and pocketed the difference and the like. So part of what I think is the contribution here is to show that these issues are important, not just in the areas where financial incentives towards corruption exists, but in more mundane sectors where in principle you think nobody would want to cheat, manipulate, distort information, but it's pretty big. And trying to solve it is essential both for policymakers to change things, but also to put in place the kind of interventions that as economists we spend such a large portion of our time trying to figure out the efficacy of. Huge economics literatures around giving information to parents, giving information to teachers, giving performance-based incentives to teachers, to students. And one thing that all of them rely on is that there is a metric to which you're tying these things. And in our research papers, we typically make sure that those are distortion-free because we go and measure them. But that's not ever going to be the scaled-up version. There will never be a university researcher who does this every year in every state and every school. So either we fix the way the state collects this, or effectively, we need to be a bit humbler about how many of the interventions we flag can actually be scaled up by policymakers in settings as they actually exist.
It's a timely reminder that the data that we all rely on does have to be collected first. And that story of how the data is collected is often more complex, more nuanced than many of us assume. Thank you ever so much for doing the research. Thank you for talking about it today.
Thanks a lot for having me. This was a lot of fun.
The paper is called Myths of Official Measurement, Auditing and Improving Administrative Data in Developing Countries. And the author, you've just heard from him, Abhijit Singh. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. Now, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform, and then you'll get all our past episodes. But also remember that you can always find them at voxdev.org as well.